From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, frustrated Michiganders try to navigate an unemployment system overwhelmed by pandemic job losses.
People have been waiting months to have their identities verified by the state and to start receiving paychecks that they really need.
Then, an emotional roller coaster of an album that fits the pandemic mood perfectly.
As long as you have someone kind of going through it with you, and understanding and showing some empathy with you in that, then I think hope is always possible.
And finally, a Detroit festival built to celebrate food of the African diaspora.
You look at something like gumbo, you look at something like jambalaya, those have a lot of different origin stories. They have a lot of different mixed cultures, heavily influenced by African culture.
Those stories and more coming up on today's edition of Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. On today's show, Detroit celebrates the contributions of chefs with African heritage and all that they've done for American cuisine.
You look at something like gumbo, you look at something like jambalaya, those have a lot of different origin stories. They have a lot of different mixed cultures, heavily influenced by African culture.
We'll check in with folks from the Taste of the Diaspora Festival later in the show. But first, we're going to deal with some of the economic realities of the moment. It's no surprise that the joblessness rates in Michigan have more than doubled since the pandemic began. That means that the state's unemployment insurance agency has been inundated with applications and phone calls from newly jobless Michiganders, many of whom have no idea how this process works. It may be their first time in the system. They're calling night and day with questions about how to apply for unemployment, how to amend their applications, or maybe to just get a sense of when they can count on their first income in months. It's not easy being in the dark about that next paycheck, especially when it feels like there's nothing you can do about it. Sarah Alvarez is founder and executive editor of Outlier Media. She's been reporting extensively on unemployment benefits this year. Sarah, thank you for joining us.
Sure, my pleasure.
So we are 11 plus months into the pandemic. What have you been hearing from community sources about whether the state's unemployment agency is delivering on the claims that people need to make?
Well, we hear a lot, and I co-reported this story with Adrienne Roberts from the Detroit Free Press, and I know she's also hearing a lot of the same things that I'm hearing. And one thing that I'm hearing is that people are very thankful for these benefits. We know that these benefits have been a real lifeline for so many people during the pandemic, because let's not forget that a lot of people have been using unemployment insurance for the first time. You know, they might not have qualified for unemployment benefits. And because of different extensions and the pandemic assistance, there's a lot more people who can use these unemployment benefits. So I think that needs to be said, that people are very grateful that these benefits exist and that they are using them. At the same time, we hear, maybe not surprisingly because we're reporters, we hear about the problems with the system. And we've been hearing a lot about how difficult it is to get through to the system, how difficult it is to certify, which means, you know, kind of jump through a series of hoops that allows you to start receiving the money. And we've also been hearing from so many people about like how unclear it is, how long the wait times are. And those wait times could be like day to day. You know, you're waiting on the phone for a few hours, or it could be months. People have been waiting months to have their identities verified by the state and to start receiving paychecks that they really need.
What are some of the most common problems you've heard about? Is it that people are able to get to the system but can't get in, or is it a matter of just getting to a certain point and then hitting a bottleneck?
So that's a good question, and bottleneck is definitely one of the things, right? Like, we definitely hear about a lot of bottlenecks, but I think most of the problems fall under kind of a tech support and tech issues umbrella. So it's people, you know, being able to log into the system, but not being able to know what to do next. It's also people not being able to log into the system. And I would say that most of the issues we're hearing about do have something to do with tech. I think the other big category of problems and frustrations that sources have told me about is really like a lack of guidance and clarity from the state about what people need to do, how long problems are going to take to resolve, and really just people wanting to hear about what they should do in plain language.
There's a quote in the article that you and Adrian reported that was just heartbreaking. It was from a guy who works as a stagehand and obviously has been out of work because there haven't been concerts and events. And he said, there's a certain point when you realize they don't really want to provide these benefits. I mean, he sounded like he'd reached his wall. Does the state have anything to say about the problems people are still having?
You know, they haven't said much. And I will say I am a little bit surprised that there's not been a more kind of proactive push to really reach out to people and let them know what's going on. I think that's a lot of people's frustration, is just feeling like they're out there on their own, even though, you know, there's several million of these people in the state, feeling like they're out there on their own, not knowing what to do and not knowing how to navigate this. That source that you mentioned, that was a really interesting conversation. And he did say, you know, when I'm able to get through, he calls on Monday morning at 7:59 and says, in the morning, right before the phone lines open, and says he's usually able to get through to someone who then can't help him. And he said, you know, the people on the phone, I know they're trying their best. I think they want to help me. They can't help me. And he did say overall, right, like the state does not feel like it wants to help people. And sources that I have talked to about how unemployment insurance works, you know, in states all over the country have mentioned that in Michigan, there are a lot of hoops that people need to jump through. And the legislature has made it more difficult over the past few years to apply for benefits, to keep benefits, and that was pre-pandemic, but those problems and making it difficult for people to access unemployment insurance, those problems have really come home to roost during this pandemic when so many people need unemployment and when so many more people are aware of how difficult the system is to navigate.
Sarah, I remember that Michigan's unemployment insurance system went through this early bout with a huge pile of suspected fraud claims. Did you hear anything about how many of those have been resolved so far, or whether it's still an issue?
So that's a great question. And a question that I have is really what is going on with fraud? So the source that you mentioned, who worked as a stagehand pre-pandemic, he's stuck in this fraud problem. He has an open kind of fraud claim on his account, and he's waiting for the state to verify his identity so that he can start getting benefits again. And he has been waiting for months. We do not know how many of those claims have been resolved. I do know that there's only about 20,000 more people kind of left in that bucket of people who still have some open issue on their claim. I don't know how many people have been able to get verified and who may have been flagged for fraud at the beginning and it turned out were legitimate claimants versus how much fraud has happened. And that's a big question, I think. I understand, of course, I think as we all do, that the state wants to be careful with this, with these benefits and with this money, because it can be very difficult to get it back. But I think that I would like more detail on how these fraud investigations are being carried out and how much money the state has recovered, and more transparency around that.
I saw a report in the Detroit News that on top of all this, the state's unemployment insurance offices are closed. Like you cannot even go down there and stand in line and wait to talk to somebody. I don't know. I don't know how many people you spoke with who would want such an option. But had you heard that?
Well, yes. I mean, I think what people want is to know how to get through to someone, right? And, you know, anything that they could do. So The state has started keeping more, well, I think they've always had it, but they've started making this data more public about how many calls they get during the last week and how many calls they're able to answer. So last week, the state got an average of 65,000 daily calls over the past week, and they handled 27,800, right? So more than half the people who called didn't get through. And that's why I think people want to know, you know, are offices going to open up? How can they get help? I think that that's what people really want to know.
Do you have any sense of what people are doing? I mean, if literally half of people who have something to bring up with the state cannot even get a phone call returned, it's not to say that everyone who does get through necessarily gets to a resolution. Do you have any sense of what people are doing to get by right now?
Well, I mean, they're calling other people. They're calling each other. They're calling reporters. You know, I have seen a lot of activity in different Facebook groups, online, on different social networks, really trying to kind of like trade information about, you know, what people can do to make their claim go through or to get, you know, to troubleshoot their claim. From the people that I've talked to, it's a pretty, people are relying on savings, people are relying on credit cards, people are relying on family, people are relying on some of those other benefits that exist during the COVID pandemic that maybe they didn't use before, like food pantries and food distribution. But I think there are some people who are really struggling. And of course, you know, the people who are having the hardest time getting through are people who need pandemic assistance, right? So they wouldn't have qualified for regular unemployment because they were part-time workers or gig workers or self-employed. And a lot of those people have less to fall back on, right? Because they weren't necessarily in very highly paid jobs before. So I do think it's a very important question of how are those folks making ends meet and what are they, you know, what can the state really expect them to do if they can't access their unemployment benefits?
Sarah Alvarez is the founder and executive editor at Outlier Media. Her recent story on the state's unemployment agency was co-reported with the Detroit Free Press. Sarah, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're so welcome. Thank you.
Next up, your new favorite record. Michael Trotter and Tanya Blunt Trotter talk about the album forged in pandemic fires. We meet the creative minds behind the band The Warren Treaty in just a moment. Stick with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Do you find yourself flipping through your music options, looking for that magic blend of songs that reflects the pain of this time, but that also heals? We think we found your fix.
Can we be lovers now? Let go of the past that hunts us down. Can we finally be found? In each other's arms above the ground. Can we forget the skin we're in?
Michael Trotter and Tanya Blunt Trotter are a married couple from Michigan who record and perform as The Warren Treaty. Their latest record, Heartstown, doubles down on their ravishing duets and their broad musical taste. Some of the songs soar like Stax Records, and others frisk and sway with the grace of Cole Porter. The Warren Treaty was formed when Michael and Tanya were living in Albion, Michigan. They've since relocated to Nashville, and that's where they were when we checked in with them late last year. Michael, Tanya, welcome to Stateside. It's great to hear your voices.
So good to be here. Thank you.
You know, the record opens up with this song, which just taps an artery of romantic despair and channels it into this incredible soaring anthem. But I have to say, when I heard it, my first thought, as a person who has been married a while, as you two are, I thought, this is a grown love song.
Oh, hell yeah.
So true.
Why doesn't anybody write about couples who were in their second or third decade together?
I don't know. I think, you know, like everything, everyone just wants something new all the time. And, you know, the beautiful thing about being in something for two and three decades or a decade itself is that you're always finding something new in that person, and that's what makes it so exciting.
Would you say that that is a thread that runs through the songs on this album, you know, just being at a certain place in life?
I would definitely say so. And Ty and I, we definitely try to write from an honest place. And, well, we don't try, we do. So Heartstown was written and composed during a moment where we were just straight up reflecting, self-reflecting on ourselves and on our relationship and on our world. And that's what you have.
Right. Could you remind us the story of how you two met?
Ah, yes. Let's go ahead and argue, Tanya. Are you ready? Because here comes the argument right about now.
Well, let me start my side, and then he's going to tell his side, and then there is the truth. But we met at a love festival in Maryland, Laurel, Maryland, to be exact. And Michael was performing. I saw him on that stage performing with a friend of his. And it was amazing. And I just had to know who he was. So I darted across the field. If anyone knows me, they know I like to wear heels. They weren't red that day. But I loved, you know, that music that he was performing. And I met him. And right away, I purchased, I think he had like these bootleg CDs. And I purchased like six of them. And I was giving them to everybody in on the that I could on the field. And we exchanged numbers. And that was it. He came over to my house. He had never done any writing for anyone before, but I asked him if he could write for my brother and I, who would, at the time we were working on our duet project. And Michael came back maybe the next day, and this was 2 weeks after his meeting, and he had the entire album complete. And I was like, this is strange. And these weren't like, you know, fluffy songs. These were magical songs. And so as time went on, maybe another 2 weeks, my brother couldn't make rehearsal, and Michael started to add reference vocals to those songs. And a friend of ours heard us singing together. And that was it. That was the magic.
I don't know who needs to hear this, but if a woman will run in heels for you, you need to go for that and hold on to it. That's important.
Tell us how you lost my number now.
Nope, we can move on.
Oh, no, you did not.
All lies. All lies.
You mentioned, you know, you said that this entire record was written, you know, that the exterior of this would suggest a relationship that is solid if going through questions, but you said that there was definitely a reflective period that came with the writing of this. Could you say more about that?
Well, just again, we just really want to make sure that we are honest in our art form and making sure that we're telling the correct story, the story that we want to tell. And for me and Tanya, it was definitely a moment of just figuring out what we want to lead with. You know, do we want to go this way or do we want to go that way with it or whatever it was? And as we continue to try to process what we were going through as a couple living in this country, one of the things that we decided to do was just be completely honest with how we felt. And that's just, you know, what you have and what you're hearing is where the road to honesty has led us. And there's more. And I'm excited about the more part, but I'm also excited about that we got this out.
So you're from Albion, but you guys are living in Nashville now. Can you fill us in on what this year has been like and just sort of what the immediate environment has had for you?
To some, it's been scary, but this year has been so eye-opening for us. And so reflective, and we were able to find the gaps in how we see things. Because you're on the road a lot, and you get burnt out, and you get tired, and you complain, and you don't want to go home. I want to be in my own bed, and I want to drive my own car, and blase, blase, and failing to realize that this life you live is a privilege, and it can be here today and gone the next. And I wish we were opening on the road. I wish we were doing headline shows on the road. I miss people. I miss watching them respond. And I miss responding to them and sharing art and creating love. And this year has taught us to never, ever take it for granted. Don't ever think that it will just always be this way and the trajectory is just up, 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 up. Because something can happen. Anything can happen to where we're all on the same playing field now. We're all sitting at home wondering what's going to happen next. And I feel that in the Trotter household and in Michael and Tanya's life, one of the things that we have bunkered down and done is just examine ourselves and really be grateful and thankful that we've been able to stay afloat.
I wanted to ask about one of the songs on the record called Five More Minutes.
Leaving so soon is like we just arrived. Did I play the right tune for your pleasure tonight? Stay with me, don't leave just yet.
Tanya, will you tell us the story that led to the writing of this?
Well, we were in Albion, Michigan, and for those that don't know about the Warren Treaty, we are a family that together we are thriving through the ups and downs of PTSD. Michael is a two-time Iraq war veteran, combat veteran, and we as a family have navigated the ups and downs of that.
Have you tasted the wine, smoked a little wisdom in the rain?
And this particular day when we were in Albion, it wasn't a good day for him. And I kind of knew it. He'd been going in and out of just depression, you know, and I could see it heading towards a more severe path. And he had made up in his mind without me knowing, without him giving any clues or saying anything, that this day was the day that he was going to try to die by suicide. And I knew that. So I called his therapist and I talked, and she said, call the police department. And I did, the Albion Police Department. And while I was waiting for them to get there, I went to talk to Michael, and I, you know, got down in a posture right in his face and on my knees. And I asked him, I said, you know, I just need you to give me five more minutes. And then the police had arrived there, and they backed me with what I was asking him to do at that moment. And he had made up in his mind, Michael did at that moment, that he was going to not just give me five more minutes, but he was going to give himself five more minutes. And he did not go through with the act. So that is where that song derived from our experience and Michael's triumph through that moment.
I cannot believe that you two were able to turn such a truly hellish situation into such a hopeful and positive song. It's really beautiful.
Thank you. You know, it's interesting because, you know, the time that we're all going through right now, I think that in putting that song out without us even knowing that this time would come, that's kind of the way we live our life. You know, it's our daily, I would say, mantra. That's a famous word everybody's using now, is to keep hope alive. You know, that in every situation, there is a light at the end of the tunnel. And as long as you have someone kind of going through it with you and understanding and showing some empathy with you in that, then I think hope is always possible.
Michael, was there a conversation about what the treatment was going to be on that song?
No. We just went full speed ahead, and we wanted it to be happy. We wanted to reflect the aftermath and not the current situation.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Tanya Blunt Trotter and her husband, Michael Trotter. Their band is The War and Treaty. Your voices are so beautiful and powerful together. There's some couples, it's not quite the same as sibling harmony, but there's some couples who, when they sing together, it's just electrifying. Could you talk a little bit about your collaborative writing process?
I wish that it was a collaborative process, but, you know, I sent him a text message this morning because Michael is a genius. I mean, to be able to watch him work, sometimes I get stuck in the moment and I'm like, I guess I can add the word the to make, you know, it's so amazing because he hears everything at the same time. You know, he'll come to me with the song and he'll say, okay, here's the melody. Here's what the piano's going to do, the drums, the horns, the strings and organ. And then now that we have the studio in the house, he'll go and make a reference of it. And I'm like, okay, so there's really nothing for me to do. But we'll go through the song to make sure I understand the lyrics. If I want to change a lyric here or there to make it, you know, fit more or whatever, we'll the compromise on that. But I mean, I've always said this, when you're in the presence of a teacher, your responsibility is to learn and to be a student in that. And there are just so many moments in The War and Treaty where I really am the student, regardless of the career I had before The War and Treaty. It's always a learning curve and it's always a challenge to hear these songs. So I would definitely give all the credit of the creative side of what we do to Michael and his 6-7 song a day process. He writes so many songs. It's just amazing to be a part of this journey with him.
Michael, is that really the volume you work on?
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah.
Wow. That's amazing. I mean, has it always come like that to you in such a flood?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I leave myself open to the voice of God, and God is always speaking, whether it's through nature, whether it's through the solar system, or whether it's through humanity and vegetation. He's always there, and I'm always listening. I'm ready.
Is there something about working at that pace that you think opens you up to hearing what you need to hear?
I realize that it's at that pace to others, and to me it feels like years.
Ah.
I'm so engulfed in the moment. Everything slows down. Time's suspended, and I'm with what is, what can be, and what will be of this material. That's where I'm at.
Mm. There is a song on the record called Beautiful that includes a cameo by, oh, by the way, one of the most famous men in music right now, Jason Isbell.
When I looked you in your face, from your eyes fell a tear. Then you went away, left us standing there.
What does Nashville offer you in terms of musical community? And people who you can connect with and sometimes collaborate with?
It has, I would say, since we've been in the pandemic, we've done something that we have not done since we were on the road a lot. We're doing a lot of writing collaborations. We did one last week with Lucy Silva's, a couple of really well-known producers with our publishing company this week. And it's just been amazing, you know, to be able to experience and exchange energy with some of the most incredible artists and producers in this town, and to realize that even if we're unable to meet with them at their homes, we are able to Zoom and we are able to do FaceTime. So it's taught us that regardless of where we are, and we can be in Kansas City, this pandemic has opened the eyes of so many of us to realize that we can do this all day. Thank goodness for Zoom and FaceTime. You know, so we don't really necessarily have to be in Nashville, you know, to make that happen.
Right. You know, to that end, there's so many insanely talented musicians. Nashville's full of them. Some of them session people who just never quite made it into the spotlight. How do you think you two were able to find your audience?
I think we're still finding them. Just being honest and true to who we are. People are starting to understand that this is it. you know, that this is real. And it's hard to make music today because so many people, they feel like they're looking for something new. And sometimes the answer is not in something new. Sometimes the answer is in what was. And just seeing a different interpretation. Not new, but different. So we're really, just really honing in on our people. And even our peers, like Punch Brothers, Chris Thiele and Aoife Donovan. And listening to like Sierra Hall or Sarah Jarosz or something like that. You know, it's just really just expanding yourself and realizing that it's an audience of one.
Mm.
And if you love music, then you'll love it all, you know?
Thank you two so very much. I mean, the record is just, it's medicine right now, and we appreciate your time and talking to us about it.
Thank you as well.
Thank you so much.
Jubilee, Jubilee.
Arts and culture coverage on Stateside is supported in part by an award from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs.
Jubilee, Jubilee.
So much of American food culture is rooted in the experiences of the African diaspora.
You look at something like gumbo, you look at something like jambalaya, those have a lot of different origin stories. They have a lot of different mixed cultures, heavily influenced by African culture.
Coming up after a quick break, we're going to check in with the organizers of a Detroit festival celebrating that cuisine. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. If you're skipping the punchki today in favor of gumbo, greens, and beignets, we've got a festival experience that you need to check out this month. Taste the Diaspora Detroit celebrates the enormous contributions that people of African origins have made to American cuisine and continue to make. A dream team of regional chefs is busy creating boxed lunches, a different one for each week of this month, Black History Month. And every lunch tells a story. Plantains with jollof rice, jambalaya with smoked turkey and andouille, black-eyed pea masala, and so much more. Food that speaks to you across miles and across the years, and across all the experiences that Black Americans bring to their cooking. The founders of this experience are Raphael Wright, you know him from Urban Plug, a social conglomerate that starts and owns businesses dedicated to improving Detroit's urban neighborhoods. Its first storefront's going to be opening later this year in Jefferson Chalmers. Rafa, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me. How are you doing today?
I'm well. Also with us is Chef Germond Booz. He's a consultant for local startup grocery stores in the city. Hi, Germond.
Hey, how you doing?
We're also joined by Chef Ryan Eli Salter. You can find him online as The Bachelor Chef. He helps people learn to cook and helps them find new enjoyment for food. Hi, Ryan. It's good to have you.
It's great to be here.
Can we start out, Rafa and Germond, with sort of how you got the idea to tell a bigger cultural story through food beyond just what people get in restaurants around town?
So one of our other co-founders, Idra Godet, put together a very impactful food distribution program around Thanksgiving, where she fed 1,000 families, maybe more than that. But she put together a very, very effective, impactful program that spread meals all across the city. And it concluded around Christmas time. So right after that, Germond, Edric, and myself started having conversations about the good, the bad, the ugly about that project. And then we started having conversations about how could we do it ourselves? And how can we do it to reflect where we come from? So January was around the corner, right after that's Black History Month. And we started having a conversation about doing this meal distribution again, but on a scale that would highlight African-American chefs, restaurants, farms, cuisines.
So in these lunchboxes, you're focusing over 4 weeks on four geographic and cultural cuisines, African, Creole, Caribbean, and the American South. Germond, well, first of all, I guess, how did you decide on these and what order they should go in?
Well, honestly, we wanted to do Caribbean the second week, but during Black History Month, Mardi Gras fell during the second week, so we decided to kind of honor Mardi Gras by doing Creole the second week. And we basically followed the transatlantic slave trade. We went from Africa. We would have originally went to the Caribbean, and then to Creole, and then just the Southern food next, just following that path that Africans would have took from Africa to America.
What was the story that you wanted to tell in choosing these specific regions and cultures?
Each region has had influence in American cuisine, and all those are popular cuisines that have a history behind them. Kind of going to each one individually gave us the opportunity to speak to the history of that cuisine and then also how it influences the current cuisine that we're in. And I give you an example where we look at something like Creole, you look at something like gumbo, you look at something like jambalaya. Those have a lot of different origin stories. They have a lot of different mixed cultures, heavily influenced by African culture. And we really wanted to kind of explore that culture through the food and tell those stories and give some background. It's only so much you can do in 4 weeks, but for us, this was a good start. This was something just to put us on the path to kind of digging deeper into the history and culture of those cuisines.
So, Ryan, I see you in position 3. Could you talk about what you built for your menu?
Sure. So what I constructed was a Bajan brown stew chicken with a plantain potato mash. And for the vegetarians, we did a brown stew tofu. So we still have, you know, the same elements. And what that comprised of is yuca, Swiss chard, collard greens, some carrots, along with the roasted chicken to make a beautiful gravy to go with the plantain potato mash.
I'm trying to remember why we booked this interview for a time when I haven't eaten in about 6 hours. This is a terrible idea. Since you were tasked with pulling together something that speaks to people about the Caribbean, can you tell us about why you chose what you did?
Sure. So I gave it some thought about what I wanted to do to represent, you know, my upbringing in the Caribbean. And I thought about my time as a kid living in Barbados and trying to think about the food that I love so much. And as a kid, I actually, you know, we all went, you know, the high fructose corn syrup, we went to McDonald's and we went to fatty foods. But the one thing that I did like that was not of that variety was this brown stew chicken. I remember how my nanny used to do the plantain potato mash, and she used to make this rosa, and she used to go and stir it in. She showed like different things how to make bakes as well. And I thought about including bakes, but I realized it's really hard to transfer to reheat because they're best eaten fresh. So I thought about this very simple, but also a very flavorful dish as well that brings up some good memories.
You know, you make a good point that this is a quick hit. I mean, you do many kinds of work from catering to helping people learn how to cook for themselves a bit. Can you just talk a little bit about using this format? I guess it's like a, you know, a haiku of cooking compared to a novel for the kind of things you want to convey to people.
I like that phrase, a haiku for cooking.
It's a lunchbox. It's not like a six course meal. Yeah.
I mean, to really emphasize, but like you said, keeping it simple, what we're all about, you know, when I heard more about the Taste of Diaspora, as you know, the other two gentlemen said, it's really about telling a story about the transatlantic slave trade, talking about Black food, things that come from our culture side, about the utilizing the ingredients that are, you know, specifically Black, and mainly from the Caribbean. You think about, you know, chicken and plantains. There's not a lot of beef that you eat down there. You really don't eat that much pork, especially in Barbados. Beef is hardly ever found. And so, yes, I do bring up a lot of varieties in catering. That's what I love about catering. But this is also something I don't usually make too often. I haven't even made it at all for my clientele or guests. So they're actually getting a different side of me trying this cuisine.
So Rafa and Jermond, one of the things that really knocks me out about what you've pulled together here is something that I kind of wish was a thing with every restaurant I visit. Every lunchbox with this regional food in it also contains a QR code. So you're enjoying your meal and you can actually find out what's going on here while you're eating. Why was that an important part of the model?
That's where product is going. You know, information is digested in this way. You know, most of us use our phones most of the time, even when we're eating. You know, there used to be a broken rule, you know, if you know, was it elbows off the table or something like that, where, you know, even entertaining something outside of the meal or the people that you were eating with. But now, you know, people use their phone all the time. So adding a QR code puts information right in front of you while you eat, but outside of while you're eating, it just gives you the information that we want you to have when we want you to have it. So you can scan it in the car, you can scan it after you eat, you can scan it whenever, but that information is there forever. So I thought it was an important element. It saves space as well. So explaining the history of these different cuisines, how do you do that in a way that is neat and cool? So QR codes is the future, and we thought it would be perfect for this project and all of our projects coming after.
Rafa actually added a Black History playlist in there too.
Oh, beautiful.
And one of the things we talked about over and over was creating this full sensory experience. And I really feel like the QR code was able to give us that particular feel for this particular project.
You had 400 boxes as a starting number for this project. How's it going? I mean, are people plugging into this?
People plugged all the way in. We sold out within the first few days of releasing. So we did not expect that, but 400 boxes flew out of the digital shelves. And that's when we knew we had something, but people really took to the concept. People really gravitated towards the mission. And I think that that drove the sales to sell the way that they did. So we definitely are super duper appreciative of that. But to answer that question, we sold out within, was it 2 or 3 days, Jamal? What was it?
I believe it was 3 days.
That's awesome. If you're just joining us, my guests today are the co-founders of Taste the Diaspora, Raphael Wright of Urban Plug and Chef Jermon Booz, who is a consultant for local startup grocery stores. And we're also talking with Ryan Eli Salter. His catering and cooking classes are found online on his website, The Bachelor Chef. Do you guys think the pandemic played into all these pieces coming together in some way, from the consumer demand end to it, to just you having the time and the bandwidth to put into this?
Yeah, I would definitely say that the pandemic has changed the way people shop. Definitely online shopping, box meals, delivery, pickup, curbside, you know, is definitely a thing now. People are definitely more in tune and aware of buying their food like that. I think prior, people were very comfortable using Amazon for just goods around the house or whatever they might need. And the pandemic has kind of shifted that consumer base to be more invested in the idea of buying their food online, which really helped us out.
I want to bounce this question over to Chef Ryan, too. I'm sure you've noticed people's tastes and people's demands changing over the course of this pandemic. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I think we all kind of gravitated towards comfort foods. You know, it's been a very stressful time. I think the year hit everybody. You know, the diets itself, I've noticed that they've been a little bit heartier. Even myself, I know when I eat out or when I go to DoorDash or Uber Eats, I'm looking for something that's very filling, something warm. So yeah, those patterns are changing. I think it's also because people aren't really thinking about being healthy as much, which is unfortunate. So you got to find a way to balance that. I try to infuse a lot of organic and healthy and less saturated fat foods to combat that, because I think we all got a little COVID weight. So yeah, the taste buds have changed. You know, we're going for flavor and fat more than anything else.
Ryan, you are so diplomatic about this. I didn't even hear the word stress eating come out of your mouth. That was very, very generous and very kind of you, and I appreciate that. With that in mind, that this moment is kind of its own weird thing, Jermon and Rafa, do you think that this experiment, Taste of the Diaspora, is replicable? Is this something you think you're going to be able to do on a permanent basis?
Absolutely. That is the plan. And then this is, you know, personal to us, is it is in the culture, is to celebrate Black history every day. So doing a project in February is a good thing, but does it do justice to the history? Does it do justice to the Black chefs, restaurants, etc.? I don't think so. So us making this a regular thing or a thing that can be continued after Black History Month is definitely possible and definitely in the works. We're working on something now and we'll be releasing that information pretty soon, but definitely replicable, and it'll be something that'll be more of a mainstay in the city. It may be outside of the city, you never know, but definitely a mainstay in Detroit. We're going to keep coming with it.
There's something about related to that I wanted to ask you about, actually, Rafa and Jermon, you know, if you two have thoughts about this. I mean, food is a joyful experience. And like Ryan was saying, it can provide a lot of comfort right now. You know, there's learning happening here. But inherent to these stories is a lot of really difficult stuff, a lot of struggle and a lot of pain. I guess this is kind of a strange question, but are there ways that those experiences can be communicated through the food as well?
Yeah, I would say that from many perspectives is already communicated, whether it just be the influence of the fact that this food is coming from slaves, you know, that alone is being transmitted through each dish almost. that's being generated and created, because the foundation for the majority of these dishes are from African slaves who were brought to this country to build it for other people. And they're leaving their legacy through their food, which we are humbly telling as we prepare these dishes each week. And then also with that, I think one of the stories that we wanted to kind of tell in particular was the hardships that Black food industry workers are going through. And that's why we chose to highlight not just Black chefs, not just Black restaurants, but also Black farmers and product developers, because as of right now, 41% of Black restaurants have went out of business or closed their doors due to the pandemic. And this particular project gave us the opportunity to create a platform to spotlight those people, to celebrate those people, and also help put money inside of their pockets as well. So I feel like in subtle ways, we're speaking to some of the hardships, whether it be the hardships of the ancestors we're cooking dishes of, or the particular food industry workers that we're representing in this moment.
This time has hit places that relied heavily on foot traffic or fine dining experiences and hit them so hard. I wanted to ask all three of you, as we're in this terrible holding pattern right now and people are experimenting with different kinds of takeout, box lunches, and just a different experience and different interface between chefs and diners. When you think about the future of Black-owned restaurants in Detroit, what do you imagine it looking like? Jermon, do you want to start and we'll go around?
Ooh, you put a heavy one on me.
Sorry. you can use your lifeline if you need to.
You know, being in the food industry, we talk about, we think about, and I would say that, unfortunately, I think it's unknown to some extent, but we know the transition away from having a packed seating area is probably a thing of the past, at least for the immediate future. So the takeout thing is something that we have to all adapt to. Being online and having resources that can deliver your food is something that we have to adapt to. But I would hope that it also is one of those things where we decide to be more cooperative in how we decide to establish our businesses. You have places like Sweet Potato Sensations that have multiple businesses operating within one place, one building. That helps eat the cost of the building itself. That helps eat different costs. So it allows for Sweet Potato Sensations to thrive, as well as the small businesses that also are underneath that umbrella. So I think that we have to kind of band together inside of the food industry and figure out ways to be unique and to circulate that dollar more in order to help us thrive and move forward as an industry.
Rafa, what are your thoughts on this?
Again, like Boo said, it is a heavy question to answer, and I agree with much of what Jermon said. Traditionally, and I don't think this is a Black thing as much as it's a people thing, we're festive. So food has always been a medium for us, you know, whether it's barbecue, holidays are celebrated with food, you know, many functions. And we've seen it over the years with pop-ups and things of the sort. Food has always been the center. With the way that we're operating now, that is definitely going to change. I think that's a change forever. We have to go digital in many respects on how we deliver food, present food cooperatively, like Boo said, that we figure out ways to work together, but we are in survival mode. So the agriculture end is going to take the front seat. So restaurants and things will still be around, but we'll see more gardens and farms and things of that nature just pop up.
Ryan Salter, there were already chefs like yourself who were thinking outside of a traditional restaurant box, but what do you think is going to be important for chefs and food producers to think through in the years ahead?
As Rafa and Jermon both said, it's definitely a pivot this time. You know, although I do love the serendipity of going to a restaurant and being with friends and the camaraderie that you have, we don't know. It's very uncertain right now, like what to expect in the future. So I think we're still exploring it. There's no definitive answer as to what to expect. I know for myself, I've seen a lot of chefs do meal planning and meal prepping, kind of what we did for Taste of Diaspora, but they're doing it on a more consistent basis. I myself didn't go that route because I hadn't the proper infrastructure. So you're seeing all these different models being placed right now. And I think it's coming to the time to see which one's the strongest. My best bet is going to be more to take out curbside delivery, have people drop in, pick up what they need and go.
Chef Ryan Eli Salter is the third week's feature for Taste the Diaspora Detroit. And we've also been talking with the founders of Taste the Diaspora Detroit, Raphael Wright and Jermon Booz. Gentlemen, I know this is a tough time. I can't believe you pulled off such a cool idea in such a crazy, crazy period of Detroit's food scene. Thank you so much for talking to us about this. We hope you can keep this up through the year.
Thank you for having us on.
Again, thanks for having us on. Thank you.
Thank you as well.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll see you tomorrow.